Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current iteration of my sermon that I'm preparing for next Sunday. Here's a question for you. Should government promote or impose religion? Now, Americans tend to have pretty shoot-from-the-hip ideas about religion and morality. In a study done by Christian Smith, a sociologist in the mid-90s, he found that most American youth believed that morality was self-evident. And so you might pop off a quick and what you think an obvious answer to this question. In the nation of Iran currently, the regime is ruled by clerics, even though they have some democratic structures beneath the clerics. In 1555, the Peace of Augsburg established in an attempt to end the violent wars between Protestants and Catholics. The Peace of Augsburg stipulated that the princes of particular territories could choose the religion of the people. So if your prince wanted it to be Lutheran, they would be Lutheran. If they wanted it to be Catholic, they would be Catholic. Many of the princes chose Lutheran because it meant they could confiscate church properties for themselves. And, of course, that continued to go throughout Europe. The Anabaptists and the Reformed would join them, and on till we get to the point where we have this thing called freedom of religion or religious liberty. Yet even in the United States, which was established as the first secular government, as opposed to all of the states in Europe that had state churches, up until quite recently, the question of prayer in public schools was a big debate. And even when a president says, God bless America, that still stirs some debate for people. And so this question is very much a live question. Should government promote or impose religion? The Congress of the United States continues to have chaplains who open the sessions in prayer. Here's another hot potato for you. Should the government or religious leaders tell you who you can and can't marry? Now, it's very interesting. If you do a Google search for interracial marriages, the question of same-sex marriage comes up almost immediately in the conversation. These two things have sort of been linked. And if you look for Love is Love posters in department stores and the like, I saw a whole bunch of them in Gap. Once you'll notice that love is love, anyone, but very quickly age comes into the picture because, well, at what age can you provide consent? Now, even just this week, I heard about this new minor attracted person as an identity label. I didn't know what minor attracted person was. I thought these are people who are really attracted to coal miners, but no, these are minors in terms of age. I had to look that up at the Urban Dictionary, and I noticed that could just be that the Urban Dictionary, you could order a mug, a minor attracted person mug, for your co-worker, Georges. So I don't know if anyone yet in this country would think that was a thing, but perhaps this is coming too, when love is love, even to all ages. Lest you want to equivocate or ponder nuance or look at both sides of any of these things, currently other regimes are bullying you to polarize. And so you must take a stand. And I won't list all the issues that this particular website wants you to take a stand on. This website is telling you what good men are. They are defining what good people are. And so no more middle ground, take a stand. And then they promote their own particular political positions. And none of this stuff is new. One of the things that we've talked about in the last few weeks is what I'll call the Persian prosperity strategy. And you see this in Ezra chapter 7, where King Artaxerxes sends a letter to Ezra giving him full power. And this isn't anything very different from the strategy of Cyrus, who is called the servant of the Lord in the book of Isaiah. There's a very famous Cyrus cylinder that you can find in the Museum of London, and it has a variety of things. And it brags how Cyrus restored worship to the gods. I returned the images of the gods who had resided there in Babylon to their places, and I let them dwell in eternal abodes. I gathered all their inhabitants and returned them to their dwellings. In addition, at the command of Marduk, the great lord, that's the god of Babylon. I settled in their habitations in pleasing abodes the gods of Sumer and Akkad, with Nabunidas to the anger of the lords of the gods had brought into Babylon. And this very much is sort of a reflection of what he did to Israel. And the Bible lauds this. Now, the motivation for this, according to the book of Ezra, is quite clear. Whatever the God of, this is Artaxerxes' command to Ezra, whatever the God of heaven has prescribed, let it be done with the diligence for the temple of the God of heaven. Why should his wrath fall on the realm of the king and his sons? This is the Persian prosperity plan. Because if King Artaxerxes can keep all the gods happy, then all the gods will continue to favor him and bless him and keep his regime in power and keep the prosperity rolling in. And in fact, Artaxerxes gives Ezra full power over what's happening in Jerusalem and the land around there. Whoever does not obey the law of our God and the law of the king must be surely be sent punished by death, banishment, or confiscation of property or imprisonment. So this seems to be a great deal for Ezra, for now he has full power to ensure that the religious law will be practiced in the land as Ezra sees fit, in order to keep the God of the Jews happy, so that the God of the Jews will continue to bless the Persian emperor. And some of you listening to this will hear echoes of this in all sorts of modern-day political things. America must bless the nation of Israel, so we will be blessed. Or America must do this, or America must do that. This is all taken from the Persian playbook. But Ezra gets down to Jerusalem, and things aren't looking so good. After these things had been done, the leaders came to me and said, "The people of Israel, including priests and the Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, and they have mingled the holy race with the people around them, and the leaders and officials have led the way into this unfaithfulness." How are we to think about this? Is this interracial marriage? Is it about the practices of the people around? This, of course, is an old story in Israel. And if you read the book of Joshua, they're told to clear out the land or so that the people don't become a snare to them. But they don't do this. And then in the book of Judges, the people have, in fact, become a snare to them. And all of this intermarriage happens, and the mingling with other gods happens. And as it goes in the book of Judges, again and again, there's a cycle of slavery, as it were, to surrounding nations, even as Israel is now sort of a slave to the king of Persia, but at least the king of Persia seems to be a benevolent slave owner. Is this a story about racial intermarriage? Well, this question actually gets quite complicated fairly quickly. Did people marry for love? Well, love often had something to do with it. Or were marriages about family connections and business mergers? Were they making political deals with the people of the land? Were they making economic deals with the people of the land? Or were most of these wives not first wives or primary wives, but secondary wives, sort of in the tradition of Jacob and the maidservants by which he filled out the 12 tribes of Israel? Is this a story about polygamy? Is this a story about child exploitation? Is this a story about oppression of wealthy returning exiles oppressing the vulnerable girls of the people of the land? In which case, many of us would say, no, that should be ended. Or is this about interracial marriage? Can you tell from the text? Do you view the story differently through different lenses? In other words, if it's about child exploitation, you'd say, yes, they have to stop it and put them away on pain of penalty of death or loss of property. If this is a story about interracial marriage, you say, no, that's a horrible thing. Why is the Bible saying this sort of thing? What kind of people and what kind of practices should it be wrong to marry? Would you want your son or your daughter marrying a slaveholder or someone who agrees with slavery? How about allowing child marriages? How about child abuse? How about child mutilation? How about those who practice child sacrifice? How about racists? How about people of the wrong political party? Where would you draw the line over who your children or who you would or wouldn't intermarry with? Well, Ezra tears his robes. I tore my tunic and my cloak and pulled hair from my head and beard and sat down appalled. Then everyone who trembled at the words of God of Israel gathered around me because of this unfaithfulness in the of the exiles. They didn't have an inkling about this before Ezra showed up. Are they just doing this because he's now been invested with the power of the king and he might put them to death or send them into exile? I sat there appalled until the evening sacrifice. Then at the evening sacrifice, I rose from my self-abasement with my tunic and cloak torn, and I fell on my knees with my hands spread out to the Lord my God and prayed, I am too ashamed and disgraced, my God, to lift up my face to you, because our sins are higher than our heads, and our guilt has reached to the heavens. From the days of our ancestors until now, our guilt has been great. Because of our sins, we and our kings and our priests have been subjected to the sword and captivity, to pillage and humiliation at the hands of foreign kings, as it is today. Ezra is looking back and saying, Israel's misfortune is because of her disobedience, because of the way that she has compromised. And they remain in exile, even under the benevolent Persians, who are paying the way for the temple to be rebuilt, in order to curry favor with the God of heaven, so that he might support imperial Persia and its imperial policies over the lands of the region. While Ezra was praying and weeping and throwing himself down before the house of God, a large crowd of Israelites, men, women, and children, gathered around him. It's making quite a scene. They too wept bitterly. Then Shechaniah, son of Jehiel, one of the descendants of Elam, said to Ezra, we have been unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women from the people around us. But in spite of this, there is still hope for Israel. We have a little bit of nuance here, where, we have been unfaithful. But maybe, God can find a way. Now let us make a covenant before our God to send away these women and their children, in accordance with the counsel of my Lord and of those who fear the commands of our God. Is that a good thing? Can these women go out? And how will they make it in a culture like that? How will they eat? Will the children be protected? Will they be cared for? Could this be a godly situation? Let it be done according to the law. Rise up. This matter is in your hands. We will support you. So take courage and do it. They're all behind Ezra. A proclamation was then issued throughout Judah and Jerusalem for all the exiles to assemble in Jerusalem. Anyone who failed to appear within 3 days would forfeit all his property. Ezra's been given this power by the king, in accordance with the decision of the officials and the elders, and would himself be expelled from the assemblies of the exiles. You're in or you're out. Within 3 days, all the men of Judah and Benjamin had gathered in Jerusalem. On the 20th day of the 9th month, all the people were seated in the square before the house of God, greatly distressed by the occasion and because of the rain. I love that we get a weather report. Then Ezra the priest stood up and said, you have been unfaithful. You have married foreign women, adding to Israel's guilt. And again, is this racism? Is this religious bigotry? Is this child exploitation? Is this polygamy? Now, honor the Lord, the God of your ancestors, and do this and do his will. Separate yourselves from the people around you and from your foreign wives. What's to become of them? The whole assembly responded with a loud voice. You are right. We must do as you say. But there are many people here, and it is in the rainy season, so we cannot just stand outside. Besides, this matter cannot be taken care of in a day or two, because we have sinned greatly in this thing. That's right. This is going to be complicated. All of these women and all of these children are going to need to find new homes, new people to care for them. Will anyone take these people in? Will they be cared for? Let our officials act on the whole assembly. Let everyone in our towns who has married a foreign woman come at a set time along with the elders and judges of each town until the fierce anger of our God in this matter is turned away from us. And that's in fact. At the end of the book describes that they do. And then there's in fact even a list of a hall of shame, as it were, of the names are named of the people who did this. And then the book ends. Now these post-exilic stories have been rather miserable. This is part of the reason nobody preaches on that, because it's not clear. There's no happy ending. There's no grand gesture. There's no skies opening and clarity coming down. It seems we can't live with sin and we can't live without it. The Persian prosperity plan would be replaced by the Greeks' way, and the Greeks would come in and they'd find the Jews ignorant, having no statue in their temple. Every good temple needs a good statue, and of course that will cause a rebellion and lots of bloodshed. The Romans will replace the Greeks. The Romans are pragmatic. They knew what happened with the Greeks. They knew how fiercely the Jews preserve and protect their independence and their separatism. So as long as the Jews obey the political order, they'll be tolerated, of course, until a Jewish insurrection, and then the temple will be destroyed. Each strategy leads to bloodshed. Now, colonists like Greeks and Romans and Persians always profess they've got the best intentions at the heart of their subjects. Everyone believes what they believe, and if they have power over someone else, if they're generous, they try to give them their best. Whether that's Christianity and literacy in the 19th century, or that's LGBTQ safety features in Tinder here in the 21st. But the picture is complicated. By the time of Jesus, we find that the sorts of syncretism that were a perennial battle in the Old Testament are, in fact, seemingly subdued. We don't find the people of Israel playing with foreign gods. We find that, in fact, Jesus has other things to talk to them about. Their nation still has identity. They're still a people. But then Jesus comes, and everything begins to change. Jesus would change the very definition of conquest when everyone imagines Jesus is going to gather a mob and turn them into an army and take cities and kill enemies and force people and bully people into one side or another. Jesus basically says, it's my side and everyone else. But he doesn't conquer with the sword. He conquers with love. And Gentiles will flood into the new churches all around the empire, even despite persecution. And we don't know what to think about these issues. We don't know what to think about these things, actually. We do know what to think about these things. Jesus answers many of these questions, but not in the ways that everyone imagines. Because what Jesus basically says is, by my blood, I will make humanity one and unite the races into one human race. By my blood, I will bring the people together. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosophy of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. How should we live? Brothers and sisters, think not of what you were before you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. He is that righteousness. He is that holiness. In the midst of this muddle, when it so often seems we can't get a right answer, He is our righteousness. Therefore, it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord.